Rhythmic Session number 1613, Reel 7.
Major Charles Burden Taylor, Reel 7. After you'd been at Weymouth, where did you go then? What happened next?
Well, we had, I think the obvious higher-ups exercise must have been to keep us on the move, and basically I think it's a good idea, because if you're actually involved, literally in battle, then you've got to be prepared to move at any old time, and this sort of practice, you mustn't really allow yourself to become too settled. But I seem to remember that we went off to Yeovil, and then nothing much happened at Yeovil except just normal training, and then we moved along westwards along the coast, and I recall being stationed on Chesil Beach, one platoon on Chesil Beach, with the rest of my company in Abbotsbury area, then to Bridport, and then on to Chiswick, and then we arrived at Honiton, and that was our kicking off point to the Middle East.
Well, let's take this period generally then. You carried on your training. Was there anything new being introduced into training during this time?
I don't recall anything new being introduced. There was always this threat of parachute landings if there was going to be an invasion in that area. And I recall, relative to that, when I went into Chiswick, I had one platoon which was right on the beach, so on coastal defence, and with the rest of the company, with two platoons and headquarters at Chiswick, and I had three Southern National buses with civilian drivers attached to me from the point of view of being used in an anti-parachute role. So if any dropped, then we would rush out, and this was rather fun, because I think the drivers rather enjoyed the fact some of the lads might not have enjoyed all the army rations, but certainly those the army rations, I think, were better than the civilian rations, and of course they ate with us. And
what was the training you did with them?
Well, we would really have an alert and a quick get together, quick fall in, quick move off to an area, a predetermined exercise, like any exercise was, and so lay it on, get it moving, finish it off, and then analyse what we'd learned or what we'd done wrong or what we thought we'd done wrong.
Did you have any genuine alerts, parachutist alerts?
Not at that time. I think it was round about that time that we had Ollie, which was Oliver Cromwell, which was the...
September.
That would be... Well, it's getting on, yes. But I think it was round about that time that Cromwell came through, which was the code word for invasion imminent. Other than that, there weren't any serious alerts. We were being constantly reminded, I think, that these sort of things could happen. On the other hand, on the social side, if you like, when I was in Bridport, I took over from a platoon at that area, and which included a very nice hall, which had been requisitioned, which the platoon commander had been running dances. And so I continued running the dances, which was rather good for morale. And you mentioned how did we get on with the civilian people. Well, they were all, you know, happy to come along and join us in the social side of life. And when we got to Chiswick, I tried to continue this in the village hall, which we had taken over. And incidentally, at that particular time, having moved from Bridport, I put up some notices on telegraph poles, you know, come to Chiswick and continue your dancing. It was only 3 or 4 miles away. In fact, illegally, I suppose, we used one of the buses to bring some of the girls in, if they wanted to come, from Bridport to Chiswick.
Chiswick or Chiddick?
Chiddick. Yes, Chiswick's London. Chiddick. Chidiock, in fact. Chideock. I think that's right. And then suddenly walked into one of the, I think, the biggest bollockings that I ever had in the army. Because at this time, of course, all the signposts had been removed. So Chiswick didn't exist, Bridport didn't exist, from any sort of parachutist dropping in point of view. And here was Clever Charlie getting the dancers going by advertising where Chiddick was, just up the road. And so all those had to be taken down. Also at that time...
Were you seriously told off about that, or was it...
Oh, no, it was a serious... I mean, I wasn't hauled up, shall we say, marched in before the CO, but I think it was the second in command at that time was Ross McLaren, but I think Colonel Beard had returned to us. No, he noveled me, I think, in Bridport. And quite right, he was absolutely right. It was very thoughtless of me. But he said, look, get those bloody posters down and, you know, quick about it. At that time, too, I'd... In our lack of vehicles, I'd arranged for my car to come down from Newcastle, and as a young officer, I suppose, at that time, I assumed that I could get away with murder because I was using the car on military business, which, frankly, most of it was, and I'd used it across country and so on, but it was neither taxed nor insured, and... I was picked up by a policeman in Bridport, and that cost me almost a month's pay and a year's you know, driving ban, which when I pleaded I'd have to drive in the army, they added excluding service vehicles. I felt a little bit put out because, frankly, the car was being used mostly on service business, but that's neither here nor there, just youth stupidity.
Did you have any training role with the Home Guard or any liaison role?
Yes, that again was at Chiddick. We had to... I mean, if there was ever a case of liaison, if there were any Home Guard who wanted help, then wherever we were stationed, then we offered that help. But Chiddick, I think, was the only time that that happened. And we used to help out... I think it was a local retired general who had organised himself a 30-yard range in Chiddick, on the outskirts of Chiddick, and we helped him on instruction of the people who were part of his team.
What did you think of the people who were involved in the Home Guard there? Were they competent?
Not for me to say whether they were competent enough, but I don't think I would have liked to have been a German if he'd been captured, or for that matter, if he hadn't been captured, because I'm sure that although lots of stories go about, but if it was a question of pitchforks and that sort of thing, then the Jerry would have got the pitchfork, because the keenness and the enthusiasm and the question of nobody's going to get over my doorstep but over my dead body, that was the order of the day, and they were absolutely first class. You had to be very tactful, I do, with them.
Why?
Just in case, well, because you know, if one was going to... We were there as, what can I say, fully-fledged soldiers. And if we were going to, what can I say, tread on toes by some unfortunate remark, because they were as keen as mustard, and that you just couldn't really stop.
What about the senior officers, retired officers? Was there any trouble liaising with them? Because they'd be a lot...
No.
You were a captain...
Yeah.
Retired general. Was
yeah.
There any trouble?
No problem. No. They, at least I say in my case, I had no trouble at all. They realised that we had a job to do. They were terribly grateful for anything that we would do to help them. And I think that the fact that we were there and helping was the main point. Question of cooperation.
When you moved to Honiton, I believe you did some extensive moor training while you were there. What was that like?
That's right, yes. Actually, it was flipping cold. But it was good. It was good training. I think it was rather hard. I recall that a lot of it was carried out, shall we say, you might be transported to an area in the area of Exmoor, the one that I remember. And then you would carry out an exercise, and a lot of this was battalion exercise work. Then you'd be transported back. But this was winter time, and Exmoor seemed to be, as far as I'm concerned, about the wettest, coldest, even snowbound area in Britain at that particular time. On the other hand, it was all a hardening up exercise and also a training exercise.
What kind of exercises were they on the moors?
There are two forms from, if I can explain it. Basically, one's got to say that really all exercises are exercises in attack, defence, withdrawal, patrolling, whatever it may be. But I think the other side of the coin was that there is a certain resemblance between the north coast of Devon and North Africa. And I think that was used to give us some hint of the sort of fighting we might be involved in later. That's rather a personal viewpoint, but I seem to remember that there was some thought at that time that a hint. And at the same time, I don't remember that we were ever taught to go zooming round in big left hooks or anything like that. It was pretty regular training.
And you were... The battalion was starting to get ready to go overseas. Were there any special preparations made to go?
Yeah, I think that the biggest or most obvious hit was when we were all starting to be issued with clothing, tropical clothing, and we were measured up by the one of the tailors, I think Mossbroth, for officers' clothing, and it's obviously that we're going out to some tropical area in the pretty near future, and we all, by this time, I think we were up to standard in transport and weapons.
One thing we haven't covered, and now is not probably the right time, but you must have had some drafts in as well.
All the way along the line, I think we were getting drafts from the regimental depot. We had had, and this is going back. This is going back to before we went to France. We got the first outsider draft that we got was from the KOSB, and which couldn't be closer in a way, except for the Sunderland Fusiliers. But we got a tremendous draft from them, and I think they were the first national service people to be called up. Maybe wrong, but I think they were.
And how did they fit in?
They fitted in just like that. They were great. There were a lot of extremely good types. Came through, a lot made NCOs for that matter.
And how about the ones you were getting from Brandsbus?
No problem. They were our own kith and kin. We also got some people from which regiment? I don't know, but Cockneys. And they just fitted in just like another set of Geordies. Their language was slightly different, but I recall one or two people quoting a chap who was talking about what's your name, and it was Fred, and he said, well, that's not a name, that's what you sew buttons on with, from the Cockney. But those sort of little peculiarities, they came and went, and they very soon found that they were part of a team.
Who was your colonel at this time, at the time of going overseas?
This was Colonel Beard, Tim Beard, who was a splendid chap.
And how about the RSM? You'd had Jennings had arrived by then.
Spike.
What did you think of him?
I thought he was absolutely first class. He called a spade right from the start. I think he exuded efficiency as an RSM. And
What made a good RSM in your view?
I think I really got to quote from later on when I was very happy to be an adjutant to Colonel Mark Leather in 2DLI. But I think somebody who really knows, shall we say, all the basics of a soldier's job, if you like, starting from weapon training and concealment, camouflage, all the rest of it. But in addition to that, knows the humanities of what it is like to be a junior leader and then a more senior leader. And then you get up to the point where, as a regimental sergeant major, you're dealing really with a battalion of some 900 or so men. And although it's not a question of knowing every one of them, he is boss in his own mess, basically in the sergeant's mess. He's got to set a standard which is above reproach. He's got to be above reproach in every direction, loyalty, efficiency, and so on. And for that matter, one might say that administratively, he's also got to be able to cope. Because some people can be a good leader and a lousy administrator. But I think he's got to be, you know, all of these things.
And you felt Jennings met these criteria?
I think so, from my experience with him.
What about Chambers, the adjutant? George Chambers.
George, yes.
What did you think of him?
I don't recall having any particular thoughts at that time. I think he might be annoyed if I say this, but...
Were there any officers that stood out in your mind as characters or particularly efficient or incompetent at the time of going overseas?
I don't recall. This is going out to the Middle East, yes. No, I don't recall any incompetent officers at all or people who didn't come up to our standard. I've forgotten his name, but one poor fellow was constantly ill, but that's not his fault. Tim Beard, I think, was one of the most sort of quiet, efficient officers I've ever come across, because he never fussed. If you had any fear about him, you had the fear of letting him down or letting the battalion down in his name.
Two junior officers who are quite well known in the battalion are English.
In English, yes.
And Chris Beattie. We've been told that they were popular officers. Did they stand out as particularly efficient officers, or do you think it was something else that made them popular with the men?
No, I think that... this is rather interesting, because Chris Beattie was my second-in-command at one time. But taking both of them... because Chris Beattie was later killed, I think, yes. No, they both had rather similar characters, because they were outlooking and outgoing. And sometimes you might say that they were over-exuberant, and one might feel that, perhaps they ought to count 10 before they spoke, or whatever. But from the point of view of leadership, I think they both of them had tremendous similarities. Because there are times when, I remember on one occasion doing something which I knew my colonel didn't like. And he simply said, when I told him that I'd had to do, well, I'd done this, rather, and he just simply said, "Charles, you made a decision." And I think that relative to Ian English and Chris Beattie, they might go charging off on a certain decision made, which might not turn out to be exactly right. But the fact was that under a given set of circumstances, they made that decision and won the day, whatever it may have been.
Were they known as popular officers with the men at the time? Or did they stand out at all?
I don't think. That's a very difficult question, because I personally can't recall any officer in the battalion that ever had... any roughness with their soldiers.
Who was C Company CSM?
This was, at that time, was Marky Craggs, and really it's rather a sad tale, because when I first came across him was at the time, in peacetime, when the carrier platoon was being formed, and I was told that this chap was going to be enlisted, and shall we say, confidentially in brackets and all that sort of thing, he was going to be enlisted over age into the TA because of his character and his capabilities. He'd been through the First War, had been taken prisoner, and he was highly rated. And I first met Marky Craggs at Stanley when we had to form this carrier platoon, and being a bit young and a bit possibly toffee-nosed at that time, I recall a slight hitch when he sort of nudged me and said, "We're going to make a job of this, sir." And I thought, at that time, at whatever I was, 19 or something, it was a little bit forward for a chap who really had rejoined and immediately made sergeant, which was quite right. But from that was the only little thing that I would have, and I don't really count it as a criticism, because he was so right. His enthusiasm really matched my own, because this was something new, and well, matched my own, and the whole platoon. Everyone was so jolly enthusiastic about it, this new new weapon or this new platoon. Anyway, that was Marky Craig, so I finally had to hand him over with the platoon to Ian English. But later on, when we were under Colonel Byrd, there was a space for a company sergeant major in the battalion, and to a lot of people's surprise, and to the chagrin of one or two regular junior to him, senior to him, NCOs, Marky Craggs was made company sergeant major. Not in my company, sad to say, but I had a tremendous admiration for him. And when we came back after Dunkirk, reformed, I was short of a company sergeant major, and I was offered someone, but I knew Marky Craggs, who was in hospital at that time, was bound to come back to the battalion, and I pleaded with the CO, could I just wait, and I'd like to take Marky Craggs as my company sergeant major. And of course the next thing was that when we were at Hunterton, and we all had to be re-medically examined, he's marked down home only. And he tackled me, such was the man, that he said, look, sir, that by the, another year, this war is going to go on for quite a while. And he said, in another year, it's the same as last time, all these home-only people will suddenly find themselves fit to go overseas. And if I'm going overseas, I want to go with the 8th Battalion. And with a little bit of fiddling, pushing here and pulling there, Marky Craggs was suddenly found to be fit.
How did you go about that? What are the wrinkles of getting a man like that through?
Well, this was really, I think, support from the Colonel, because he was a fellow who, I mean, I loved Marky, and but I shall we say the Colonel recognised him as a fellow with tremendous potential, and supported the question of the medical officer putting up a strong case that perhaps home only was a little bit too tough to put this splendid chap. And I think nudges
so
up the line.
You put pressure. Was it pressure put on the medical officer or pressure put on the next level up, the medical board?
I would say, well, I don't think at that time we were actually boarded. One was given directions, I think, through the medical channels as to what constituted home only. And I must say that, bless his heart, Mark used to smoke like a chimney, and I think I'm right in saying it was always captain full strength. And with the sort of cancer aspect that one has nowadays, one can understand that he would probably, on that side of medical chest problems, made home only. Well, that's, I suppose, from medically not difficult to push him one or two grades upwards. But anyway, the main thing is that pressure through medical channels got him graded to go overseas.
So who actually in the end changed his grade? The medical officer or...?
It would have to come down, I think, through to finally being okayed by the medical officer, but I wouldn't like to guarantee that. I don't recall him going on a board, but it may well have been a board. But this was wartime. In peacetime, I'm certain it would be a medical board.
What kind of a man was he? What were his qualities as a CSM?
He was a small man. He didn't look a CSM. He was always smart, well turned out. But he wasn't, shall we say, the sort of Spike Jennings, who was about 6 foot odd, like a ramrod, and could be heard from one end of, shall we say, Durham City to the other. Marky, he drilled well, and by that I mean he drilled the men well. He knew exactly how to do things, what to do, but his qualities were tremendous loyalty, tremendous understanding, and, shall we say, recognition of the other person's point of view. And he wasn't a bully. He was about one of the kindest men, and I suppose nowadays the psychologists would have some clever word for it. But he was just admired by everyone. He did his job tremendously well. He never shirked.
You'd learned that in your early days. You'd learned the differing roles of the officer and the CSM.
Yeah.
What was his part of the... He was mainly administration, was he?
Oh, no, no. Well, you could mainly administrate. Yes.
What was his administration?
Yes.
Right?
No, I think that at various returns that had to be sent up, strength returns, sick returns, getting ready people for parade, for that matter, compiling the company orders, the daily orders, getting the petty sessions, company office ready, and that sort of thing. But I think just as important was, apart from, shall we say, the drilling aspect, and, shunning and unshunning, was, what can I say, indirectly training his sergeants and the NCOs within the company, and really getting to know everybody's problem, and tactfully bringing certain things to notice. If I can say that I haven't got a good memory, I don't think I ever have, but the teamwork that existed between he and myself, that if I ever forgot anything, I'd know jolly well that he'd remember it. And very rarely did he forget anything, but it so happened that I would be the one who, if he'd forgotten something, I would have remembered it.
In action, this is moving on slightly, but would he have a tactical role in action? Would you consult your CSM in action as to what, especially a man with his experience?
I think that, no, I think one would. I mean, he was older than me, and as you say, with his experience, one might say, of course, the experience of the last war, but a shell in the last war is not much different from a shell in the second war. And if one's under pressure, and perhaps a little bit wondering or a little bit worrying, I think it's quite a relief anyway to talk things over. I don't mean that you had a whacking great committee in running or anything like that, but I think it's a stupid man who doesn't take advice from somebody who's had a far greater experience.
What about your second in command? That was Beattie, was it?
No, that was a chap called Regnart at that time. No, I think Chris Beattie had gone off to the anti-tank platoon, or to be an anti-tank company at Brigade. I think each platoon really was one that was going to be used with each battalion, 6th, 8th and 9th. And I think I lost him, and I've forgotten his first name. Ray Regnart, I think, was my second in command at that time.
Did you work well with him?
Oh, yes, quite well, yeah.
What about the CQMS at the time? What was he?
He was CQMS Ledger, and which seems to me to be a very good name for a quartermaster or a quarter colour sergeant. No, he fitted in tremendously well, and he was, again, of the old TA stock. I don't think that I can say anything more, that the company was well-equipped, well-run, the reaction to any inspection, if there's anything short, or any kit shortages, they were obviously very well made up, very quickly made up.
How would you compare this C company with the C company a year before? Would you, you know, the C company that had gone off to France, would this be a more efficient company? Or
I think that it's probably right to say that we were a more efficient company. I think from two points of view. One, the majority of us had some experience under fire and realised what it was all about, which can give you, I think, a slight sort of dig in the ribs to press on just that little bit harder than perhaps we were, despite Brigadier Jackie Churchill's pushing in the early days of the war. And the other side of the coin, I think that we had more moves in that particular time. I mean, we'd had the moves in the battle area, but they were rather, what can I say, uncontrolled or forced upon us. But in this short time that we'd had back in England, I think we'd had more moves than we'd ever had before. And this idea of being able to pack up quickly and get out, and also, for that matter, the training that we had had, for instance, over Exmoor and the Dartmoor area, I think, yes, we were certainly more experienced, and therefore we must have been more efficient.